Hey folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Our guest is Ron Sexsmith. You may remember he was on the show in February of 2023. If you missed that one, he was live in the studio and played some songs. You can find the archive of it over at wfmu.org/Michael and take a listen. This one is a little bit shorter, and we sort of talk about the new album and then just a bunch of random things kind of fill in the blanks. He's such a nice and interesting and introspective guy. It was a pleasure to talk to him. RonSexsmith.com is his website, and he's on tour. He's playing in Massachusetts, if you're getting this on the day the podcast is released, but he's going all over the United States and then up into Canada. So check out his website to see if he's coming near you. He always puts on a great show, and here it is, my chat with the great Ron Sexsmith. All right, It's Been a While. That's from Hangover Terrace, Ron Sexsmith's new album. And Ron joins us on the phone, I think. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning. How are we doing?
We're doing pretty good. Really enjoying this new album. I see that you grew up in St. Catharines, which some parts of are just a few miles from Niagara Falls, therefore a few miles from the U.S. So growing up, did you go to Buffalo to see bands or to play gigs or to shop or to goof around?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we were just talking about this last night. I mean, most of the concerts I saw were in Buffalo. Elton John in 76, The Who and The Stones, and we used to go different places. Peter Gabriel, he would play, I think, like Kleinan's Music Hall, and I saw The Kinks at the Buffalo Auditorium, you know. So about 90% of the shows I saw were in Buffalo, because it was just like half an hour from where I lived. And also, when I was, the drinking age was younger, too. So when I was 18... I couldn't drink in Canada, but I could go over the border and have a beer or two.
Yeah, New York State was definitely one of the last places to go higher. I'm the same age as you, so it was I grew up in a ridiculous world of drinking too much as a teenager.
Yeah.
So the early days, you start playing in bars, and folks often refer to you as the human jukebox. How many songs did you know then? Could you just play off the top of your head? And how many are still in your brain?
Well, I just did the homework, right? Because I was kind of eager to please. And so when I got this gig at this local bar, my older brother, I mean, he was playing there before I was, and he said, you're going to have to learn. And he gave me a whole list of songs I had to learn. By all the usual suspects, right? Neil Young and all that, Dylan, Beatles. So I learned a whole bunch of songs. Then every week people would come and request songs for me to learn. Sometimes they'd even buy me the record, so I'd go home and learn it. So I learned hundreds of songs. I don't know if you know this, I have a YouTube channel called Ron Boy, which is spelled RawnBoy. And I've probably done about 1,000 or, you know, maybe more songs, cover songs of people. Just in my kitchen with my pajamas on, you know, it looks very amateur. But yeah, I have a very good memory for songs, you know. I could do a whole night of Dylan, like, in a half an hour from now and not have to rehearse or anything, you know, and do these 7-8 verse songs. So it's sort of a savant thing, a spectrum-y thing I have, but I can't do anything else, so, you know, at least I can do that.
So let's talk about the new album, Hangover Terrace, recorded in London. How do you say the producer's last name? Martin
Tereffe.
Tereffe. He's worked with some huge mainstream pop acts. What was the process? How was it different working with him?
Well, I think he was working with me before he worked with some of those people. You know, I did a bunch of albums with him in the early 2000s. Some of my favorite ones, actually, like Retriever and Cobblestone and Exit Strategy. And then it was, the last time we worked together was 2008. And in the interim, I mean, he's worked with all these people, you know, like Engelbert Humperdinck and K.T. Tunstall, Jason Mraz. Not to say that I had anything to do with that, but he's just a very talented producer. And I think he just really gets me. I think he knows how to update my folky songs and surround them with interesting production. So we were super excited to be working together again. I just like how he works. It really makes sense to me.
I think this is your 17th album. As your career has progressed, do you have more input on the production side of things? Has that grown?
I would say so. I kind of always had input. I think my early records, because I was, you know, shyer or whatever with Mitchell Froom and Chad Blake, sometimes I wouldn't speak up. If I, you know, because I was trying not to have a knee-jerk reaction, Some of those early albums sound quite weird now, you know, though, because they were very cavalier with how they recorded, you know. Like if somebody slammed a door, that would make it into the record somehow and things like that. But I just found it really fascinating. I learned so much from Mitchell Froom about song structure, so that I think by the time I moved away from him and we just, you know, I worked with Steve Earle or whatever, I'd learned so much. I had all these ideas of my own about structure and arrangement ideas. But I'm not a producer, so it really is a collaboration. But it's just something I've got more vocal about and more confident. Like even with this album, you know, every day, because we recorded the songs exactly in the order that they appear on the album. Ah. So I knew what song we were doing every day. So I'd walk from the hotel to the studio and I would have my song kind of mapped out how I wanted it to go. But by the time I got to the studio, I had a whole new idea for how we could approach it. And sometimes Martin, too, would have an idea of how to do something. It just felt really free, and really, every day I look forward to, you know, getting back in there.
Yeah, a lot of the songs have a little bit of chatter before or after the song. Is that just sort of indicative of the looseness that was happening?
Yeah, although there was more chat originally, and I actually had to tell Martin, I think we could do with less chatter between songs.
Yeah.
You know, I like a little bit of that stuff, you know. So they sort of whittled it down to a few moments. But, you know, because the Beatles did that, right? And Dylan, there's a lot of those, they sort of broke the fourth wall, right, sometimes. Because it's pop music, you know, it should be fun. It's not classical or jazz. Although I guess it'd be kind of cool if you listen to a classical record and they were talking between songs. That might be cool. But it's just trying not to be precious about it.
17 records, it's a lot of songs. You're still a relatively young man. I mean, but a lot of folks your age do sort of run out of steam in terms of writing songs. Is it just luck? Is it hard work? Is it great inspiration? Are you working harder now or easier to write songs?
I've never had a dry spell or whatever they call it, you know, because I never had a big selling album. Every record is another opportunity to make, you know, win somebody over, make a first impression. I remember when my first album came out, I thought everyone was going to hate it, but it got all these really good reviews, and it sort of put the pressure on to make sure that I wasn't a fluke, you know. So by the time I made my second album, I had a stockpile of about 40 songs, you know. I just wanted to make sure, if I'm going to do a record, I don't want any bad ones on there. I really want the quality control to be consistent. And, you know, but I'm writing now as much as I ever did. Sometimes I don't want to, you know, I just want to, it's like, it kind of drives you insane a little bit. But it's just, I don't know how to do anything else. It's just one gift or whatever I've been given. And even that, it's hard. Like, I pull my hair out over the lyrics. I think now I'm finally singing in a way that makes me happy. I think my first 6 or 7 albums, I wasn't singing very well. It's just a total work in progress. But I don't know about, maybe other people get lazy, or they just, the well runs dry. I don't know what happens, but certainly there's a lot of, most of my heroes, I think, kept writing quite strongly throughout their career, like Warren Zevon and Gordon Lightfoot. You know, Dylan keeps writing songs, and, you know, Tom Waits hasn't made an album in a while, but, you know, when he gets around to it, it'll probably be really great, you know.
It sounds a little bit like you are motivated by not exactly fear, but like there's like someone's, you know, like there's a little bit of a fire behind you pushing you forward. Is that accurate?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And that's always been there. As soon as I found out I could write songs, it was like game on in a way, you know, all of a sudden. Because I never felt I could contribute. I had really anything to contribute before that. I wanted to sing. I liked to sing, but nobody ever said I was a good singer. You know, it was like, so it was just getting in the door was really hard. It took me a long time to get signed. I mean, I was 30 when I got signed, which is kind of old for the music industry. But I really was so grateful for that I wanted to make sure I took it seriously and have a body of work, right? I wanted to, you know, yeah, not be a fluke, not be a flash in the pan or something. So there's a fire that keeps me going. It's like when you have something that makes you feel useful, you kind of, you don't feel useful when you're not doing it, you know. Like during the pandemic, when I wasn't able to go out and perform, I felt really useless. And so, you know, it's like, it's just my one thing, you know, that I'm, my one thing I'm able to offer the world. And not everybody likes it. You know, it's not like everyone loves what I do. But you know, I know there's people out there who are into it and happy when I have a new record coming out. And so I always bear that in mind.
Right? I've experienced this thing with music fans where they just can't even imagine the idea of writing a song. Like the idea that the song didn't exist, you know, for eternity. And then one day Ron Sexsmith or somebody made it exist in 4 minutes or 4 days or whatever it took to write the song. So what was the transition from guy, you know, playing 1,000 songs in a bar to writing songs? And you sort of alluded to it earlier that that was a very magical moment.
You know, I had bands when I was a teenager and we wrote some truly horrible songs, right? Like stupid lyrics, like Hard Rock Party and all this kind of stuff, right? Just because we didn't have anything to say, really. But I think what happened with me is when my son was born, it was a huge moment in my life. I was so young, I wasn't ready to be a dad or anything. But and I was living in the middle of nowhere in Quebec with my partner, and I was a new father. And all of a sudden, all these songs started popping into my head. It was really kind of spiritual in a way. That had never happened to me before. And I had read interviews with songwriters that I liked who said similar things, you know. They would have these ideas and pop in their heads, and all of a sudden it was happening to me. And so it gave me this sort of feeling like, wow, I know what I have to do. I have to somehow get to the big city and try to make this happen. And yeah, but it took me a while too. Like, I mean, there was a lot of promise in some of my early songs, but I still hadn't figured out how to do it, and I had to learn all that, like the structure. And again, I learned some of that from Mitchell Froom, and just I was a very good student of other songwriters in terms of being concise, being economical with the lyrics, try not to get too fancy, know what my weaknesses are, you know. So it was just a lot of trial and error until I kind of, like, it's still hard. I still take sometimes months trying to finish a song. I walk around, think about it, come back to it, tweak it a bit, you know. There's just it's just an amazing thing, really, that for whatever reason these ideas come to me, and it's my job to notice them and to, you know, and honor that and try to see it through, try to complete a thought.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You said you walk. I read that you walk every day, so I'm curious, how far do you walk? And I read that you swim every day and you visit the same coffee shop every day. What does it tell us about you that you do all those things every day?
I'm a compulsive person. I need a routine. I get stressed out if there's not, you know, coming out on the road, for example, my whole routine goes out the window.
Yeah.
I have to try to find a new routine. Like when I was in the studio recording, you know, I walked the same way every day to the studio, went to the same coffee shop, and all that kind of stuff. I think for whatever reason, I need to do that to write. When I was a courier delivering packages in Toronto, I wrote most of the songs for my first and second album on the job. Because I write in my head. I don't need to be around an instrument to write or anything. Because usually that's the last thing I do when I have a song started. Then I'll go to the guitar or the piano and figure out what chords might go with what I'm singing in my head. So, yeah, you know, I walk. I mean, I don't swim every day like I used to, but I go to the YMCA every day and I do a bunch of futile exercises. But I walk there, and the whole thing takes me about an hour or so. It's about a 20-minute walk to the YMCA where I work out for about 45 minutes. Then I walk home. So I do that every day. But now that I'm on the road, like I just went to the hotel gym today, you know, I try to do that as much as possible because, you know, I'm 61 and my weight goes up and down, and it's hard to go on stage when you don't feel presentable. At least it is for me. So, yeah, it's something I need to do for my head. That's also, and again, it's also how I write. So
Let's talk about guitars. Do you have a lot of them?
I do, but I really only bring one on the road. I have a Taylor guitar that I've been playing since 1995. It's a real battle axe. It's been everywhere. It's been lost, been broken, and I've just had it repaired a couple times recently. But it's my comfort zone, you know, when I have it with me to walk out on stage with that guitar. Sometimes people will take pictures of the guitar before I even come out on stage because it's kind of become almost like a celebrity in itself or whatever. It's funny because the label bought it for me back in 95 because I was playing a guitar that I was opening for someone and everyone said my guitar sounded like crap. And so the label just sent me a Taylor and it arrived about 50 minutes before I had to go on stage by FedEx, you know. So I had to open up the box, walked out on stage, and I've been playing it ever since.
I read that you've been collecting frilly shirts since 1997. How many shirts? Because they make you feel like a rock star. Do you get these in thrift shops as you travel around the world, and how many have you got?
Well, you know, it started in 1997. My band and I were shooting a video for a song called Strawberry Blonde. You know, there was a wardrobe person that was working on the video shoot, and she had a whole rack of shirts, and there was a bunch of frilly shirts in different colors. So my band and I, we all put one on, and it became our thing for a while on the road. Like, we would wear these suit jackets with frilly shirts underneath, and I just always loved them, you know, because, you know, I like how they're not all like macho or anything, you know. It's not really my character to be wearing jeans and a t-shirt. I've always been very in tune with my feminine side. So I don't have as many as I used to, but I used to have probably about 7 or 8 all in different colors. The only one I bring with me now is this powder blue one that I still love to wear because it looks good under a blazer. You know, you look at old pictures of the Stones and stuff, they're always wearing frilly shirts, and you know, that's the people. Those are the rock stars I grew up with, and I just that appeals to me. So,
yeah. Let me remind folks that Ron Sexsmith is our guest. New album's called Hangover Terrace. Information at ronsexsmith.com. And you're on tour tonight and tomorrow in Cambridge, Mass. At Club Passam. You are in Saratoga Springs in Fairfield, Connecticut. You'll be in Montclair, New Jersey, in our area next Friday, the 12th, at the lovely Outpost in the Burbs. You'll love that venue. It's in an old church. It's fun to play. And then you're all over the place: Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia, Tennessee, Georgia, Michigan, Illinois, Minneapolis, and then a big tour of Canada. So all of those dates are on your website, ronsexsmith.com. So what's a good sign when you walk into a venue? Now you've been doing this for so long. What's like a good sign and what's a bad sign when you pull up and you walk in there for sound check and you're checking out the place?
It's always nice when you get a good dressing room. Like, venues are kind of iconic for different reasons. There's a lot of iconic rock clubs, you know, that they're not, you know, they're kind of dives in a way, but everyone's played there. So there's a kind of, you know, it's sort of an honor. But you go in the dressing room and the walls are covered with graffiti and everything, or sometimes obscene graffiti. And then there's rock band stickers everywhere, you know. But every now and then you walk into a nice songwriter venue and the dressing room's nice and they've got the coffee going and the loading is easy. Sometimes the loading, you got to walk up 2 flights of stairs, or, you know, there's always something to complain about, right? But generally, once you're in there, once the room is full and you're on stage, you just make it your own thing, you know, and the people make it. It's really a two-way thing between the artist and the audience. And that's where the magic comes from, if there is any magic. So there's a lot of venues I love for very different reasons. There's a place that I'm playing called Eddie's Addict in Georgia coming up. And, you know, when I played it on my last American tour, when I got there, I was kind of moping around because I found out there's another act playing, there's a songwriter circle going on, and we all have to share the dressing room. And so I was kind of sulking about all these different things. But then comes showtime. It was one of the most amazing shows. I felt so much love from the audience. And so I've learned from that not to have a knee-jerk reaction about places, even if they seem a bit, you know, dubious up front. Because, yeah, you make your own vibe every show. You walk out and the room becomes yours. the lights go down, and you could be playing Royal Albert Hall, or you could be playing Eddie's Attic, you know. So
yeah, make the best of it. Sure. As I was reading reviews of the new album, I could see that, and I was kind of looking at some of your older reviews of your records. I could see that reviewers, music writers, seem to be trying to figure out what your current state of mind is by listening to the songs, right? They say, oh, Ron's in a melancholy mood, or he's angry, or he's romantic. So is that fair to do that? Because it seems to me that the songs would have a connection to your current state of mind, but is it fair to assume how you're feeling from the songs?
I'm really an open book, right? Mm. So if I'm singing it, I'm feeling it. You know, maybe I'm not feeling it when I'm on tour, because the song was written a year ago or whatever like that. Right. But, you know, I mean, everything I write, it's a balancing act, because I don't want to write in a way that's claustrophobic, right? I don't want to write where it's like the diary for everyone to read. But you know, also I don't want to tiptoe around things. I want to be concise and articulate everything so that people aren't scratching their heads and wondering what I'm going on about. Sometimes, you know, it's unavoidable, I guess. But yeah, I mean, like, for example, this album, I think, is a very different vibe from my last few. And I think I've said it in a few interviews, that just coming off the pandemic and the last few years, that seemed really hard, not just on me, but on a lot of people. Having had some falling outs with some friends, I've had just some feelings of being excluded from things and cast out from things, and whether real or imagined, you know. But all that stuff, it goes into your songs. All that stuff that thinking, or I'm hurt about, or I'm happy about. And, you know, because this album's got all sorts of songs, love songs and humorous songs. But yeah, there's definitely an edgier vibe, I think, to some of the tunes on this record.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So you've been doing it a long time. How do you put a set list together? And, like, what's your strategy to make it the most effective thing? And how does it change? How much will it change from night to night in a tour?
It is hard, I find, to put a set list together, because I have so many records.
Yeah.
And a lot of second guessing goes into it. You don't know who's coming. Maybe someone's coming hours, they've driven hours to see you, and their favorite album is, you know, Exit Strategy or something. And so I try to... I always aim to play at least one from every record, but, you know, the more records you have, it gets harder to do that, because unless you want to play for 3 hours or something. But thankfully, my songs are quite short, so I can squeeze quite a few of them in. There's probably about 5 or 6 songs that I'm sort of expected to play every night, like Secret Heart, Strawberry Blonde, Golden Hills, and so there's certain songs. Like in England, for example, a song called Get in Line was a number 3 song on the chart. So when I'm there, I play that one. Sometimes I don't play it in North America. The freedom of playing solo is I can have a set list and then completely throw it out the window when I get on stage, right? Because people start yelling out songs or whatever. And also people request songs too, like in emails. And could you play this one in, you know, Georgia or something? And I can easily adjust it, so, but it's tricky.
Yeah, but I guess you've got enough songs, so it's like a challenge, but it's also never keeps you on your toes, and you'll never get bored of your set list. Tonight and tomorrow in Cambridge, Mass, and then September 12th in Montclair, New Jersey, at the Outpost in the Burbs, and then all of those places we mentioned in between and afterwards. Go to ronsexsmith.com for information and information about the new album called Hangover Terrace. Let's hear the song Rosetown. What do we need to know about this one?
Well, Rosetown is a song kind of about relief, of looking back over my life and just being kind of relieved that I've arrived at a different place or a happier place after years of turmoil or something. So yeah, it's pretty straightforward. And I like it because it's kind of, you know, the lyric is quite serious, but the music is quite poppy and happy sounding. And I like when you have that kind of push and pull, or the tension of that. But yeah, so it's a song about, yeah, just being in a better place, really.
Let's hear it. Ron, we'll see you in Montclair. We'll see you in the road. And thanks for visiting with us again.
Thank you. I really enjoyed chatting with you.
Come on.